kind of the story you know from your insider access to the Pentagon first. And correct me if I'm wrong, you worked at the Near East South Asia desk, is that right?
That's right, that's right. I was actually the North Africa desk. That's the subset that I worked. So I did not work inside of OST, Office of Special Plans, but we were co-located with those same folks for some time. And obviously we worked for the same person, Bill Luddy. So I have some observations that, while not exactly inside of the Office of Special Plans, they're definitely about as close as inside as most people are going to get.
Okay, well, what is the Office of Special Plans?
Well, that office is actually closed now. It's been, done away with as of last fall. But in the summer of 2002, they started manning up at the Pentagon, Undersecretary for Policy, Doug Feith, started bringing in a large number of consultants and outside contractors and that kind of thing to work Iraq. That's what we were told anyway, that they would work Iraq. And so when it got to be about 18, 19 people, they split off as a separate office, which was described to us as the expanded Iraq desk, and that was known as the Office of Special Plans. And at this point, the product, once they split off, the product that they provided to the rest of us in the Pentagon, I'm sure there were other things, but the thing that they provided to me and other desk officers was a set of talking points, which were constantly being updated on any topic relating to Saddam Hussein, Iraq, weapons of mass destruction, and terrorism. So we were directed to include those talking points in any papers that we sent up to our senior civilians so that they would all be on the same theme. And there's really nothing wrong with that. To have everyone on the same theme is not a bad thing at all. But the problem is the information that was contained in these talking points was not objective intelligence. It was really subjective interpretations of data bits that lent themselves to the pre-existing theory. And the pre-existing theory of the neoconservatives was that we need to take down Saddam Hussein for any number of reasons. The reasons we're going to use, the reasons that will sell this takedown, that will sell this preemptive war, are weapons of mass destruction, relations that Saddam Hussein has with terrorism and terrorists, and possibly insinuating, at least, that Saddam Hussein had links to 9-1-1. Those were the key emotional reasons that would speak to the American people, and this is what we were being forced to include in our material up to our senior civilians so that they then could promulgate that information to their guests and visitors and foreign ambassadors and that kind of thing. Now, the interesting thing about it was that as I looked at these talking points, I had seen intelligence on Iraq at least the secret level, for years, even when I worked on the air staff. And this information was seemed to me to be a manipulation and a misuse of the existing intelligence, basically an exaggeration of what we had. And that's one thing. But the other thing, as I looked at these talking points, was they were very similar to the same things or to the items or content of speeches being given by President Bush and Vice President Cheney during that same time period, the fall of 2002. So what upset me, and this is about the same time I started writing for David Hackworth, and what upset me was that it seemed as if not just the American people through these public speeches, but the people inside the Pentagon were all being propagandized. That's what it seemed to me. Now, that was then. That was 2002, the fall of 2002. I left the Pentagon in the spring of 2003. I checked out the Monday after we invaded Iraq, and so I'm then a civilian, basically. I'm out of the Pentagon. And since that time, since the little over a year that I've been out of the Pentagon, all of those things that I thought were manipulation of intelligence, that I thought were exaggeration, that I thought were false juxtaposition of unrelated data bits in order to present a particular story, all of those things have since been proven that, guess what, my gut instinct, my observation of this was actually correct. Now, that's very sad. That's not something that I take any pleasure in at all. I would like to have been wrong, okay? If you do a preemptive war, you must have crystal clear and rock-solid intelligence. That's what you have to have if you're going to say that our policy, our foreign policy, includes our right to conduct a preemptive war. That's fine, if you want to say that. But you need to make sure that your intelligence supports that decision. And in fact, we had exactly the opposite. We had a policy of preemptive war, and yet we had intelligence that was basically Plato for the neoconservatives.
Well, in fact, you told LA Weekly that they knew for sure before the war that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, that it was not just that they were wrong, but they were damn liars and they knew it.
Well, 96% of everything that Saddam Hussein had, 96%, had been accounted for. And we knew what he had, and we had been monitoring him and bombing him for 12 years. We knew what was coming in and going out. We were paying a lot of attention, a lot of intelligence attention on what was going in and out of Iraq and what Saddam Hussein was doing with his diminished capability militarily. He had a diminished capability after we kicked his butt in 91. Okay, so, and since that time, we'll continue to bomb him, we continue to monitor him, we've got all kinds of, you know, coverage on this, where he is a key focus of our foreign policy, both during the Bush senior years, the Clinton years, and the first year and a half of the Bush administration, second Bush administration. We're watching Iraq, right? So we're gathering intelligence, we're focusing on what he had. 96% of what we knew he had been accounted for, either destroyed or somehow locked up. 4% had not been. That 4% was a subject of much debate. Now, when we think about the famous speech that Colin Powell, Secretary of State Colin Powell, gave to the UN right before the war, when many of us felt that he had basically come on board with the administration completely, with his demonstration, you know, the PowerPoint slides, physical examples, here's how much of this he has, here's how much of that we know he has. This is what Colin Powell says. Now, later he says, well, maybe I was misled, whatever. He said that based on an extrapolation of the unaccounted for 4%. Okay, the unaccounted for 4%. Now, that's okay. If you want to say we don't know where 4% of it is, if indeed it's not an administrative error, if indeed this stuff retained its total viability from the late 80s in the case of chemical or biological toxins, if you say he's got some means of activating any other weapons of mass destruction based on this 4%, then fine, you can say that, okay? And then that can be argued. But that was not what we did. What we did was what Colin Powell did. And the neocons would say, well, we don't know about this, therefore he must have it, okay? He must have it. It must be all viable. And if we extrapolate that out, this is how many tons or whatever it is. And so, you know, is that really directly lying? You know, I've said before that it's lying. I think it's definitely misleading. If you make an argument with someone, you're trying to prove your point, you need to lay out in that argument what your assumptions are, okay? That's not what the neocons did. They didn't lay out their assumptions that our assumptions are those 4% are viable, because that could have been argued. But, you know, they didn't bother to do that. And so, in a sense, it's definitely misleading. Now, have we found any of this stuff? No, we haven't. Okay, we haven't. Now, even just recently, do you remember in the news about they found traces of sarin on some old pre-1991 stuff?
Sure, yeah, the bomb that went off on the side of the road.
Yeah, well, why isn't that, you know, major news? Well, that's what I think Sean Hannity was saying just the other day. He was saying, hey, here's major news. We found sarin. We found weapons of mass. Well, wait a minute. Now, you found traces of decomposed sarin, stuff that had sarin in it from a long time ago. Not the same. And that's why it's not got the news legs that the Bush administration might like to have, because it doesn't substantiate the assumptions the neocons made. Now,
well, and Scott Ritter really burst bubble yesterday and with his column in the Christian Science Monitor, where he said that if this was a new shell somewhere, then you would be able to tell by looking at it.
That's
if it was
right.
A fire dud that... Yes. The insurgents found out in the desert somewhere and tried to use it,
yes.
Then that's not so much of a big story, and that's why the shutout on the news about it was because it was obvious to anyone inspecting it whether the shell had been fired before or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And so the truth on the ground, the facts on the ground, have never and probably won't ever substantiate the things that the neoconservatives told the administration, what the administration then told the American people. So we went to war on false pretenses. And now, at the time that I was in the Pentagon, you know, we hadn't gone to war yet, right? I mean, ideally, some logic would have taken over and a smarter, wiser foreign policy would have prevailed. Did we really need to do this war? That's what I'm thinking at the time. Now that we're over a year into the occupation, it's pretty much out of control. The lives for the Iraqi people is worse than it was for most of them. In fact, the overwhelming majority feel that it's not a liberation, but it's a conscious colonial-style occupation based on the fact that this country has potential wealth in its oil. So that's what the Iraqi people think. So much has changed in the past year, but my observations of what I saw going on are consistent. What I saw, what I suspected, what I felt was happening really was happening. American people were being lied to in order to conduct this war. Now, I do believe that there are strategic, geostrategic reasons that the neoconservatives have wanted this war, and it's not that I believe it, but you can read what the neoconservatives have written over the past decade, the past 15 years, about the Middle East and about the United States' role in the Middle East and the things that they felt needed to be accomplished and how those things might be done. If you read what the neoconservatives have written, sure, there are geostrategic reasons that could have been argued for why we needed to go into Iraq and why we should go in, why we should have gone in at the time that we did, prior to sanctions being lifted, that kind of thing. There are all these reasons. However, none of those reasons were presented to the American people, and to date, none of those reasons have been presented to the American people as some substantiation for why we're still there, why we're occupying that country.
Right. Well, and in the run-up to war, as you discussed before, the official line was, and from reading your writings, this official line came directly out of the Office of Special Plans, was Hussein's ties to Al-Qaeda, which never existed, and the weapons of mass destruction, which never existed. And I believe you've often used the term, they cherry-picked the intelligence. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, what exactly do you mean? Is that like they went to the basement of CIA and got everything and then went back through it all?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, that's what they did. I mean, that is what, in fact, even before the Office of Special Plans as an expanded Iraq desk was set up, in the year before that, I mean, shortly after 9/11, Rumsfeld appointed a small group of folks, just a couple, three people, I'm not sure who was, it's been written about before. I think Cy Hirsch has written about it, others have written about it. But he did have some folks, a handful of folks. I think Cambone might have been involved in it as well. Cambone, who later became the Undersecretary for Intelligence, that new office that was created by Rumsfeld. So Rumsfeld tasked these staff members, these senior appointees, to go back through exactly that, to go into the basement, to pull all the raw reports and other kinds of data that was sitting there. Because, you know, it's a huge vacuum cleaner. Our intelligence, you know, we don't have a $3 trillion intelligence infrastructure for nothing. It vacuums up everything. So it's all kinds of things. A lot of unsubstantiated reports, reports of different things that were single source. In fact, some of Chalabi's information was included in that, stuff he had given the CIA back in the early 90s, but they were unable to confirm or substantiate any of this stuff. So it sits there as unsubstantiated data bits, and a lot of it's false, obviously. So what they did is they did go through all of this stuff, and they looked for reports of information that would fit their paradigm. And their paradigm was Saddam Hussein is so evil, he must be working with terrorists. Saddam Hussein is so awful, he must have something to do with 9/11. He must have been, you know, if you have that paradigm, then you can relook this information. And if you find data bits that support it, you say, oh, this is really good. Why don't we pull this back up and put it in the front of the pile, or the top of the pile? And that's what they did. Now, the intelligence community, as far as I'm aware of, was really, while it pulled that stuff to the front and said, okay, yeah, we did have this report and that report, for the most part, the analysis was the same. It was, it's fine, but it's one piece of data. We can't confirm it, therefore we can't go forward with it. Or, in the case of the Niger forgery, or the information about Saddam Hussein going to Niger to get yellow cake, you know, which would have been, I don't know how many train loads worth of that stuff taken into to Iraq. I mean, it's totally ludicrous. But the CIA looked at this information and said, no, this is not, you know, this is both a forgery, and even if it wasn't a forgery, we would look askance at this, given that yellow cake comes in huge truckload sizes of tonnage that then has to be processed with a capability, an industrial capability, that Saddam Hussein does not have. So why he would want yellow cake makes no sense. Now, this is what intelligence officials and analysts do. So they look at this, and so even though this stuff was dredged up and all these single-point reports were looked at, the intelligence community still did its job, in my opinion, in trying to say, well, yes, you have this. It's a single point. But we can't confirm it. Therefore, we could not put that forward. Now, who did put it forward? Who did take some of these single-point things that were not substantiated and put it in things like, let's say, the State of the Union address that the president gave? Who did that? Well, it wasn't the CIA that put it in there. George Tenet has said as much. It was guys from the Pentagon, other appointees, guys in Dick Cheney's office, you know, who else was it? It wasn't the New York Times that put it in the State of the Union. It was the folks working for Bush that had this paradigm that said, this is what we have to say in order to get the American people on board with this preemptive war, invasion, occupation of Iraq.
Well, but George Tenet did tell George Bush that it was a slam dunk case, right?
Yeah, he did say that, and there you go. Why has he still got his job? Because if you go into...
Well, why is he taking Doug Feith's line from over at the Pentagon? If the CIA didn't know that all this stuff was true, why would he say that?
Well, he's a loyal person. That's what Bush wanted him to say. I mean, Bush wanted this war very badly. You know, I think I've said neocons convinced Bush. I don't call Bush a neoconservative because neoconservative reflects a political philosophy that is a little more complex than what I would give George Bush credit for embracing.
He's a typical Rockefeller Republican. And Cheney and Rumsfeld are, you know, typical Cold Warrior type right-wingers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As opposed to the neocons who are, a bunch of ex-communists.
That's true. And, you know, what you find in, what you find with the neoconservative geostrategic view and the things that they want to do, that it fits very nicely with the Cold Warrior's perspective. During the Cold War, when we had this huge, conventional... And nuclear enemy that we were, you know, all working against. I mean, the Cold War made things very simple for these people. Once the Soviet Union collapsed under its own weight and disintegrated, obviously it still has nukes, but, you know, Russia has nukes and nukes are around, but we don't have this, huge, massive enemy, to react to. Cold Warriors didn't know how to deal with that. Cheney and Rumsfeld, and Wolfowitz, to me, they have taken their same Cold War views and tried to force those views to fit a mold, replacing the USSR with this some idea of this global terrorism against the United States. They hate us because we're free, and it's totally ludicrous. It doesn't fit. It doesn't work. However, I say it doesn't work. It doesn't work philosophically. It doesn't make a lot of defense sense for America. But you know what? They've gotten what they wanted. They certainly have what they wanted. They have, we have our ring of bases throughout the Caucasus in Iraq now. We have, this huge military, $500 billion military budget for the last couple of years, and into the future we'll still have that, I'm sure.
Are you underestimating the terrorist threat? I mean, aren't these people very dangerous?
Well, they are dangerous, but not in the conventional way, of course. Obviously, unconventional warfare. The way to fight terrorism is actually been written about by a guy at the Army War College, Jeffrey Record, wrote a really good piece published in, I think, late December or January of this year. And he looks at how the Bush administration has chosen to fight the war on terror or to fight terrorism, how they've chosen to reduce terrorism around the world. And what he says is that what everyone knows, you don't fight conventionally if your enemy is fighting unconventionally. What you have to do is get inside of his... you have to get inside of his decision circle, his OODA loop, as we used to say in the Air Force. You get inside of his head, you see what's motivating, and you see how he's operating, and then you hit him where it hurts. You look at the weak points. Now, these weak points are things that we all know. They're funding, okay? They're criminal operations. It's, you've got these funny ads about how if you smoke a marijuana cigarette, you're somehow contributing to terrorism. Well, you know, this idea of how do... these terrorist groups make money. Well, sometimes they sell opium out of Afghanistan. You know, sometimes they sell cocaine. I mean, there are ways to fight these guys, but these ways are not conventional, and they are the least important of the organizations involved is the Defense Department. It is, you know, what you want to look at is justice. You want to look at Treasury. You want to look at international police cooperation. You want to look at good governance. Okay, you want to look at all kinds of things. The Defense Department is like number 8 in the contributor of how to really fight terrorism, and yet Bush has made them number 1. Okay, so are we succeeding? No, we're actually creating more terrorists every day, and a good many of them will come from Iraq. All these people we've abused and kids we've killed, they all have cousins and brothers and family members, and so we're just growing new people that hate America. So the Bush administration, the choices that he's made to fight terrorism have not only not worked, but they have actually fed the, you know, it's basically like, hey, we'll put out this fire by pouring kerosene on it. It's stupid. Most people wouldn't do it. Bush is doing it, and the neocons are supporting it. Because to do what we're doing, which actually makes terrorism worse, but it does do some things that the neoconservatives want. One is forward presence in the Middle East, forward military presence in the Middle East, and we have that now. So they've succeeded in what they wanted. It's not winning the war on terrorism, but you know what? Why should we, right? I mean, it feeds the beast. You know, we have, as long as there's a big bunch of terrorists out there, and we've got the Defense Department, we give them $500 billion, but it won't be enough, you know, their budget is guaranteed for the future. They've got a great storyline when they go to Congress and say, we need more money.
Yeah, or when they go to Congress and try to revoke more of the Bill of Rights.
Oh, sure, absolutely. In fact, that works great. Yeah, absolutely. It's great to have a big terrorist threat to justify all kinds of, infringement and destruction of our Bill of Rights. And that's happening every day. And I think that the backlash is not organized enough and not powerful enough. And so every day we lose more.
All right, Mrs. Katowski, in the last week, a National Review writer followed up accusations made against you by Senator John Kyle of Arizona that you are a Jew-hating, Lyndon LaRouche-following ideologue conspiracy kook. Now,
yes.
I believe after having talked to you before on this show, and having read many of your articles and columns, that these charges are silly. But I'd like to give you the opportunity to confront these before we get to the perhaps less gratuitous challenges made to the story you have told about the Office of Special Plans and so forth. So,
mm-hmm.
First of all, do you hate Jews, Mrs. Katowski?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. In fact, the interesting thing is people who, in this country, and actually in foreign countries, but primarily in this country, who have criticized the neoconservative foreign policy that we currently embrace in this country are often tagged with the anti-Semitic label. And the interesting thing is, it's about 70% of the Jewish Americans in this country are in that group that criticize the neoconservative foreign policy. So I don't know what that makes them. It's
self-haters, right?
Well, I mean, but it's not, you know, that's stupid. It's a stupid thing. They aren't self-haters, and none of the rest of us are anti-Semitic. There are people in this country who are anti-Semitic, and they shouldn't waste the label on those that are not. We don't need to be labeled, critics of the administration do not need to be labeled anti-Semitic. It is unless they are. I'm certainly not, and most of the people I know that are critics and critical of certain aspects of our current foreign policy are not anti-Semitic at all. In fact, if you look at our current foreign policy, it hasn't done a thing for Israel, not at all, for Israel's security, hasn't done anything for Israel's popularity. It hasn't done anything for Israel's economic growth. It hasn't helped Israel at all. In fact, you could go to Israel and ask an average Israeli on the street, and they'll tell you that.
Do you think it was supposed to help them?
Well, from an American neoconservative perspective, and from a general rest of the population perspective, Israel is an important ally that we have in the Middle East, no doubt about it, and I believe that. One thing that the neoconservatives have wanted to do, though, is to put an American forward presence. We already had one in the Middle East for a long time with our bases in Saudi, Kuwait, and other locations, but it wasn't perfect, and we still had a lot of enemies. Once we occupied Iraq, and we've built 14 bases and rehabilitated, you know, existing bases. I shouldn't say we built 14. We have 14 bases we can operate from with American specs in Iraq today, and this is a way of saying not only is Israel a forward ally in the Middle East, but in fact we are Israel's forward ally in the Middle East, and that's a different thing. So, and that should be argued, that should be debated. Is that our foreign policy? How does that work? Does it help Israel? Does it hurt Israel? Does it help us? Does it hurt us? These are things that should have been debated. They weren't debated. It's part of a neoconservative perspective, and they're free to have that perspective. What they're not free to do is to make our foreign policy without some kind of American discussion of what it is that they're really doing. Because it wasn't liberating the Iraqi people, okay? That's not what it was about. It wasn't about WMDs, okay? It wasn't about terrorists. It was about the other parts of the neoconservative agenda, and that should have been debated in this country, and we could have decided what makes sense, what works best for our trusted ally in the Middle East, what helps Israel the most. What we're doing does not help Israel. So, I'm definitely not anti-Semitic. In fact, a lot of what drives me is concern for the danger that we're putting our allies and friends in the Middle East in today because of George Bush's policy.
Do you work closely with Lyndon LaRouche?
No. And not only that, I am, like, reading this stuff going, where does that come from? I don't even know Lyndon LaRouche. I know very little about his organization. Lyndon LaRouche, before 9-1-1, he used to have, I guess, members of his organization, they had like a newspaper, and they used to stand out, before 9-1-1 in the security, they used to stand out in front of the Pentagon and hand out their papers to people. And I took one time. Actually, you can't really avoid it. One time. And all the other times I walked away. But the one time, and what I saw in the front of it was that Lyndon LaRouche is a registered Democrat. He considers himself a Democrat. Now, the Democrats don't like him because he's a nutball, okay? But that's what he calls himself, a Democrat. Now, I grew up in a Republican family. Never changed my politics. I was for small government, accountable government, and you know, basically trust in the Constitution. And so I had to leave the Republican Party about 6, 7, 8 years ago to the Libertarian Party, which is, you know, the party of principle, whatever you want to say, libertarians, okay? Small government people. At no point in time was I associated with not Lyndon LaRouche, but even the Democrats. So, no, nothing there.
I think the accusation in the National Review was that you gave an interview to somebody from his organization, and
this
that's what
true.
Makes you work closely with him.
Sure, and they mentioned Jeff Steinberg. I know Jeff Steinberg. He's a nice guy. Jeff Steinberg is one of over 100 reporters that has contacted me and to whom I've spoken, given information on the record, of course, in all cases, and, you know, talked with. And he is obviously referenced my stuff. So when a guy who works for Lyndon LaRouche, who is a reporter, who is a researcher, uses my name, well, fine. Why don't they say I'm a member of the New Yorker, you know? Cy Hirsch has mentioned my name. Other reporters at the New Yorker have talked to me. Jason Vest has talked to me. Okay? Tom Ricks at the Washington Post has talked to me. Why don't they accuse me of being part of the Washington Post insider crowd? No.
Well, I'm not sure that would be much better than calling you a LaRouche.
That's probably true. But it's definitely a smear. And, you know, the interesting thing, John Kyle, I'm working with his office now. I mean,
Senator from Arizona.
Yeah, Senator from Arizona, Republican Senator from Arizona. He has given a speech, and it's on his Senate website, where in a footnote he slanders me, or I don't know if slander is the right word, but he promulgates this smear that actually came from guys like Michael Rubin over at the American Enterprise Institute. In fact, Richard Pearl told a guy who came to my house, a BBC reporter came out to the house several months ago, and he asked me on camera, he said, Richard Pearl tells us you're a member of the LaRouche Organization. Is this true? And, of course, I said, no, it's an evil smear. And I'm sorry that Richard Pearl is promulgating this. It's unfortunate that he's degrading himself to, you know, basically attack people that have served in the military and done a good job and are telling the truth. It's unfortunate. So I had an opportunity. So I know Richard Pearl had been saying this months and months ago, and he's over at the American Enterprise Institute, as is Michael Rubin, who wrote the story in the wrote a couple of criticisms of me along those lines in the National Review online. But that's the source of it. John Kyle, no offense to the good senator, but he's not thinking this stuff up on his own. He is getting this information from other sources, and I'm pretty sure this comes from American Enterprise Institute. Guys like Pearl, guys like Michael Rubin who are promulgating this. And again, it's a smear. They do it to everyone. I mean, they call all kinds of people names. Anyone who criticizes them gets called names. But Kyle, because I don't believe he generated this, certainly, but because he's promulgating it, I have formally asked him through email, faxed letters, phone calls, etc., to no response so far, but I've asked him to correct the record, to cease and desist, and to correct the information that is contained in the speech that he has published on his website and that he gives. He gave the speech to Center for Strategic and International Studies. He gave the speech to the Council on Foreign Relations. So he's out there using his good name as a senator to slander or smear me, a regular citizen who's critical of the administration at this point. And, you know, it's a real shame. So I am working with him. As far as the AEI and the NRO, or the National Review Online, guys like Rubin, you know, these guys are in it for themselves. Life's getting pretty hard for the neoconservatives these days. I guess if you look at the news, I mean, Chalabi got his house circled. I mean, they went and took his computer. He's off the federal dole now with his $335,000 he's getting every month for the last I don't know how many years.
Well, and they're accusing him of being an agent for Iran.
Sure, sure. But see, the thing is, and he may well be. And the thing is, as they focus the light on Chalabi, it brings a very dangerous shadow, or I should say, spotlight on the neoconservatives in Washington who were closely working with him and who were advocating for him, who were taking his bad information and, in some cases, providing him with classified information that he then is accused of giving to our, you know, people in Iran. So they're in bad shape. Neoconservatives, some of them are going to be in trouble. If any of them are dual citizens, they might be wise to exercise that. Maybe they'll end up in jail, and it'd be nice if they did, if they've done anything, you know, illegal. And it seems very possible. When you hang with, you know, when you, what is it, when you lay down with dogs, when you lay down with fleas, what is it, when you lie with dogs, you get fleas? I don't know. This is a problem for them. So I'm not their problem now. The things that they're angry about are the things that I said last year over things that I observed in 2002. That's what they're angry about.
Okay, well, and speaking
of
which,
news, really.
I want to, you know, the whole Jew-hating conspiracy kook thing I think we can leave aside, but he also made some more specific criticisms. Michael
mm-hmm.
Rubin did.
Sure, he did.
In fact, you were just now talking about the talking points that the Office of Special Plans sent around
mm-hmm.
To propagandize not just the public, but you folks in the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
But Michael Rubin, in his National Review column, says that the talking points were no big deal at all, that that's the way they always do it, and that you're making a mountain out of a molehill there.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not the way they always do it. It's simply not. Now, if you read the Rubin article, he is referring to a lot of information that was put out and later corrected by me, by Jeff Steinberg, number one. So there are some technical things where he says, this is what Jeff said, and it's not true. And in some cases, I agree with him, yeah. And I corrected that with after I saw what Jeff had sent out, I sent him an email. So there's that. But his issue that this is normal is not true. We had a page and a half to three pages that we were made to insert into our read-ahead background papers and that kind of thing. Normally, those documents are only two or three pages. So we were doubling the size of the documents that we sent up to our superiors in order to prep them. And that material we were given by special plans with the direct instruction that we were not to delete any of it, we were not to modify any of it, we were to use it in its entirety, and we were not to use it twice. 2 weeks went by and we had another tasking. We were to call up and get the very latest version of these things. Now, that is very unusual, okay? It's very, very unusual. The other thing is that office was primarily put together by consultants and contractors and political appointees. That, again, is unusual. Usually the political appointees in the Pentagon and other parts of government are sprinkled, okay? They're sprinkled throughout, which makes sense because, you know, the president puts his political guys in to kind of act as, you know, apparatchiks or whatever within, you know, political officers. Almost in the all parts of government where the president wants to make sure that he gets you know, good information and that his view is put out consistent. There's nothing wrong with this. All the presidents do this. But in the case of Office of Special Plans, you had one, two, three, four permanent type civil servants, a couple of loan officers, the legal officers were loaned from I think the Joint Staff, and the rest of them were political appointees, contractors, and consultants. All working on this neocon agenda. So that's unusual, you know. But Rubin's one of those guys. Rubin's the guy who came from AEI, you know, to do this stuff.
He also says that you worked at the Africa desk and therefore
right.
that you were in no position to know what was going on at the OSP.
The things that I've spoken are the things that I've seen. We had shared staff meetings. Obviously, I got the talking points from them, as did all the other staff officers that had to put papers up the chain. And I knew some of the guys personally because we shared space with them for 3 months before they actually physically, you know, moved out. So I have that insight. That's what I'm going on. That's what I've said. And I've not been unclear about what I saw, what I didn't see. I've been very clear about it. But again, you know, this is, you know, Rubin's whole thing is, I mean, these guys are very much panicking. The interesting thing to me, I've already mentioned that the timing of this is kind of unusual because, you know, so far, it's a long time ago in a sense, but also the fact is that upsets them is that everything that I've said and written about, both while I was in the Pentagon and after I left, has all been pretty much confirmed. So I think this is what bothers them, and I think that's why I'm being attacked now. And I take no pleasure in being right, okay? I would have given anything for this to have been a real justified war, that 800 people, 800 of our soldiers didn't die for some stupid political reason. You know, you can't take any pleasure in this. No American can take pleasure in what's gone on in Iraq and how we got to where we are. It's an awful thing.
Well, and you brought up before what a disaster it has become over there.
No,
bombing
yeah.
weddings.
It's out of control.
The new Delta Force prison at the airport that they're talking about now. Chalabi, the handpicked guy, they're now turning against him.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think guys a lot smarter than me have said this. General Finney warned them repeatedly about what was happening. Some of the old generals who, Zhukov and these kind of guys who worked for Bush's father had also warned him in the run-up to this. Brzezinski has warned them. All the people that knew have warned these people. They didn't listen. You've got guys like William Odom, retired General Odom, who works at Hoover, I think, Hoover Institute. It's a very strong conservative think tank. Basically saying it is strategically unwinnable. Bring soldiers home. Strategically unwinnable. No option on the table allows you to win strategically this thing in Iraq. This is what we have gotten by following this neoconservative foreign policy. It's a complete disaster. And part of it is because it's based on false assumptions and lies. And, you know, if you start off with any philosophy and you ground it, you know, feet of sand or feet of clay, that's what happens. It crumbles.
Well, and now they're all turning on each other, too. I notice
they have to.
Bill Kristol has been
there. They'll all go down. They're all looking for survivor now, you know, to survive. They're like, animals in a group, and they're going to turn on the weak ones. And the question is, who will be the first weak ones to be sacrificed? And I think the rumors are that Fife may be one. Certainly he was close to, he worked and facilitated the influence that Chalabi had. So, they'll be looking to pick some people off.
Well, this
really
guy,
ugly.
Fife, he's not only was the head of the Office of Special Plans and the Counterterrorism Evaluation Group, but
mm-hmm.
isn't he also the guy that, he was the point of contact with Chalabi, and he's the guy who threw out the CIA State Department plan for the occupation and put in his own.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know exactly, was it him, was it Wolfowitz, was it Rumsfeld, but yeah, it's a policy question. He's the Undersecretary for Policy, yeah. It'll be easy to hang him for that. And, Cambone may go, too. Cambone's not very likable. Neither one of those guys are usually likable. So, if you think about who's going to get killed, it's the guy with, now is when the charm comes in. You know, Pearl is, amongst his group, is liked. People have liked Pearl for a long time, among his friends. You know, people that aren't his friends obviously don't like him. But Fife and Cambone, I think both their personalities are reported to be a little short on the charm side. And so they may be the ones that are sacrificed. But they all should be sacrificed. But, yeah, we're getting to watch a survival race, a race for survival among the neoconservatives.
Do you think these are the same guys who were running the Black Ops program, Copper Green, that Seymour Hersh wrote about last week in The New Yorker?
Well, I don't know anything about that. It's certainly, I read about that just like any other person. I go, well, that's interesting. Cambone, the only thing I can tell you about Cambone is what you already know. He's very much a trusted insider, neoconservative viewpoint person, brought in by Rumsfeld. He was an assistant to Fife. I worked with Fife, I guess, in policy. I'm not sure exactly different roles that he had. In fact, it was unclear exactly at some point what role he had. And then he was made the Undersecretary for Intelligence, which was a brand new undersecretary. There had been four, now there are five undersecretaries in the Office of Secretary of Defense working for Rumsfeld. And this one is the guy that runs all the intelligence stuff. You know, you've got that General Miller, who was down at Guantanamo, who came in last the fall, I guess, of... 2002, was it? No, three. The fall of 2003, sometime in August. Remember when they fired the guy? They fired that one reserve general who was working down in Guantanamo because he was letting people have access to the Koran and he was actually treating them nice. So they said he's a soft guy. We don't want him. They brought in Miller, General Miller, who ranked him by one star. I think he's a three star. And then Miller then moved to, visited and advised them on Abu Ghraib and other prisons. So this Miller guy, he traces, this is about the same time that we have Cambone as the Undersecretary for Intelligence. Miller's an intelligence guy. We're looking at all this to make it all line up. Yeah, there's culpability here. The organization was altered such that certain things could be done, and the folks that resisted those things were moved out of the way. This is typical of how they've been working from day one.
Well, and there's been a lot of press given to the splits within the administration, particularly between Colin Powell and the neocons. And I guess Cheney's kind of playing the referee here between, like, you remember, was it 6 months ago, maybe more than that, that they came out and said that they were going to take all the operational stuff away from the DOD and give it to Condoleezza Rice? And
I remember,
remember
that?
That
fall, and
it
I don't know
never
what
happened,
that.
Right?
No, yeah, that was weird, wasn't it? I think when they write the history of this, they're either going to say that we had a great competence in policy manipulation by the neoconservatives, or we're going to say what an incredible incompetence the Bush administration in foreign policy, you know, we've witnessed. What an incompetent administration it is. It'll either be one of those two. In the case of Condoleezza Rice, and I remember that big announcement, she was going to bring everything under her office, and I think it had to do with the operations and the occupation, because it wasn't going very well last fall, going much worse now. And then nothing came of that. So what is that? Is that by design, or is that just sheer incompetence?
Well, as we discussed, bad news is good news. So even if it is incompetence, it can only delay things, which makes it much more likely that we can go into Syria next.
Well, you know, the thing is, it's not clear. If the neoconservatives, the key neoconservatives who are making policy, if they self-destruct, then, you know, what will that mean for a continued push of our neoconservative foreign policy in the Middle East? I mean, certainly Iran is continue to be portrayed as the big enemy. If you listen to the speeches among guys like Michael Rubin, who criticized me, I mean, he's part of his thing is we must have democracy, we must help democracy grow in Iran. And if you hear the extreme amount of criticism of Syria, even though President Assad bent over backwards to help us in very constructive and concrete ways in this war on terror, he's still painted as the evil enemy, he must go. This fits in with the neoconservative Middle Eastern blueprint. Will they be able to keep moving forward with this if they self-destruct back in Washington? It'll be interesting to see. You know, Kerry hasn't put forth so far anything different than what Bush has. So from a neoconservative perspective on Middle East policy, Kerry may be perfectly suitable for what it is that they want to do, which is basically to throw our weight around there in the Middle East.
Well, and you talk about the a herd of animals turning on the weak one. Seems like George Bush is probably even weaker than Fife. I mean, when you think of weakness in the administration,
right.
The bumbling doofus at the top seems to be the number one choice there.
He's done an awful job of articulating. I watched him a little bit of his speech he gave up in Ohio or someplace. He was talking to people. What about foreign policy? It's about domestic issues, jobs, or something. And he just, I don't know if he went off the teleprompter. He must have. And it was just incoherent what he was saying. You just didn't know what is this guy talking about. And if you didn't know what you were watching, if you didn't know he was the President of the United States, you would think this was some kind of town hall. The village idiot had stood up to go off on a long conversation with himself, and you were all watching going, what is this guy talking about?
Oh, man.
But in fact, it's the President. It's not the village idiot. It is the President. I don't know how he got there. I don't know why he doesn't stick to his teleprompter. I don't know why his speechwriters don't help him out. The man is very inarticulate, he's not doing himself any favors yet. I think he does appear extremely weak in getting a handle on what's going on. And you're right, his neocons have no loyalty to George W. Bush.
No, they all come from the left anyway.
They come from the left, absolutely. Now George W. Bush is no small government Republican. He's a Lyndon Johnson, basically, except without Lyndon Johnson's political skills. And so he's not like it's Republican versus Democrat, okay? It's big government people versus other big government people. So this is what we have. We don't have Republican government. And you know what's interesting? Don Devine of the American Conservative Union, did you hear about that story? I think Robert Novak wrote about it.
Oh, I missed it.
Yeah. Well, the American Conservative Union had a big black tie saying Bush spoke at it. It's an important thing because there's a huge amount of donors and conservatives there. George Bush gets up there and he gives a big speech and, you know, rallies the crowd. And Don Devine is, the vice president of this organization, a traditional conservative guy, refused to stand up at any time, refused to shake the president's hand, refused to applaud at any time. and he was sitting at the front table. It wasn't like he was back in the audience. He was sitting at the head table. And so it was very obvious that he was making a statement. And that's what he did. And that's what all conservatives should do when facing George W. Bush, because George W. Bush is not, he's not a conservative.
Oh, he's a typical Rockefeller Republican from the Northeast, just like the rest of them.
Exactly. And so, you know, he's not doing, you know, Bush actually has to reach out to his own so-called base and communicate with them, much less reach out to the you know, the independent voters or other voters who may consider, you know, do I vote Bush, do I vote Kerry, do I vote third party? You know, he has to reach out and convince his own base that he represents them. Don Devine's not convinced. You know, this guy knows what a conservative is. He says, we don't have one here. We're not looking at a conservative. So, anyway, and Bush can't even communicate on basic issues of domestic policy. So I definitely think he's over his head when it comes to the mess he's made in the Middle East.
Well, and you talk about reinforcing his base. I don't know if you caught this thing. I think it was a Jim Loeb column, something about the Village Voice got a memo.
Oh, yeah, from the religious thing. Yeah,
where they were telling the Apostolate Congress, don't worry about giving up Gaza. That won't interfere with Jesus coming back.
No, they said that Elliot Abrams, big neocon over at the National Security Council, he's at the Middle East desk, was assuring these left-behinders or whatever they are that, yeah, don't worry about Gaza. Yeah, it's amazing. If that's what our foreign policy has come to, then we basically have gone back to the Middle Ages in this country. You know, can we fix that? Can we move forward? I hope so, but yeah, what you're looking at is just, it's almost like, it's just surreal to think that this is how our policy is being made.
Well, and really, I mean, pulling out of Gaza, what pull out of Gaza? They're just going over there with bulldozers and demolishing everybody's house. I don't see anybody leaving Gaza.
They're not pulling out, and it's all just an unfortunate game. And you know, the interesting thing, or the sad thing is, that had the Bush administration truly been interested in solving the problem of the Middle East, addressing Israel and Palestine issues, they have issues, they've had long issues. Neither side, both sides want to solve them, and then at the same time, both sides don't want to solve them. So it's a tough problem. Had we put energy and effort into resolving it, even more than Clinton did, far more than Clinton did, if had Bush done that, he could have actually won a Peace Prize, you know, won a Nobel Peace Prize. He could have done such fantastic good had he harnessed the energies towards peace. He didn't do that. And so now he's going to go down in history as a bumbling idiot who has killed unnecessarily literally thousands and thousands of people. That's what history will write about George W. Bush, is that his reaction to 9-1-1 not only was inappropriate, but was a bait-and-switch operation to pursue other agendas that were never shared with the American people. And this is what history will write about him. And it's very sad because he had an opportunity when he came in, and I don't think he's going to get a second chance. You know, I don't think he's going to get 4 more years. He may well, but I don't really think that he will. And so his 4 years have been utterly wasted. This guy could have made a huge difference with the root causes of some of the problems in the Middle East. There could have been a genuine pullout from Gaza, a genuine pullout, not what we are seeing from Sharon and the troops now, but you know, we really could have had progress if he had chosen to focus on that particular problem, because he has the support of the religious right, because he has support of conservatives. You know, it's hard for a Democrat to go and do these kinds of things because they're always criticized for wasteful foreign spending and that kind of thing. But for a Republican, just like when Nixon opened with China, had a Democrat tried to do that, it would have been highly criticized. But if you have a conservative, hawkish-type person, staunch anti-communist, who then, with that foundation, goes forward and deals with this enemy in a way that's actually cooperative, actually generous in some ways, this is who can do it. Bush could have done that for the Middle East. He could have been the guy to actually take major steps and strides forward towards peace in the Middle East. But he didn't do it. He frittered it all away, the potential, and what he does have, what he has delivered to us, is a much more dangerous situation, not just for Israelis, but for Arabs and for Americans.
If you had been on the White House staff or some higher level like that when September 11th happened, what would have been your advice to him about how to react? what would have been the proper reaction to September 11th?
Well, in some ways, initially, they did that. They asked questions, what is this and how did it happen? It seems like we never did get to the real answer about what was 9/11, about how did it really happen. We're still waiting for the commission to produce its report. That commission only exists because four women from New Jersey, four widows of folks that were killed on 9/11, insisted that there be a commission. This president didn't even want this commission. He'd failed to cooperate with it repeatedly. And now they have this commission. It's going to produce some watered-down report this summer. What really happened? Well, first off, that didn't need to take over 2.5 years, okay? It didn't need to take 2.5 years. That would have been step one. Find out what really happened. That leads to your second step. What do we do to put an end to this? And quite frankly, if you look at 9/11 and you say, well, looks like Saudi money, a lot of Saudis involved, maybe we need to talk to the, you know, House of Saud over there and find out what's going on and what we need to do to resolve some of this. But of course, Saudi Arabia received limited criticism of this. Now, it's interesting, the neoconservatives hate the Saudis, and in some ways they would have, I think, treated the Saudis much more harshly. And Bush, of course, the House of Bush, House of Saud, that book by Craig Unger, you know, there's a lot of linkages. They go way back with the Bush family. And so Bush had his hands tied. As an advisor to Bush, if I was such an advisor, I would have liked to think that I would have said, Mr. Bush, you're not just a Bush, you are the president, okay? You got to put aside these linkages that you have and these loyalties that you have and really get to the bottom of what's going on. Instead, what Bush apparently did was authorize the multiple flights when there were no other flights going on. He authorized a number of Saudis to leave the country on flights that were the only flights flying. We had planes grounded for 3 days, and on day two, a bunch of Saudis left the country. So that's not, I think, what I really call getting to the bottom of what happened in 9/11. And so if you don't do the first step, which is to find out what happened, how can you possibly go forward with the next step to how do we deal with it, how do we prevent it, how do we reduce risk? That's not what he did. He didn't find out what happened in 9/11, or if he did, he didn't share it. He didn't act on it. What he did was he said, we're going to go kill a bunch of terrorists, and that's fine. Let's chase them down. You know, let's hunt them down, like he said. And then we're going to go into Iraq because, you know what, we've always wanted to do Iraq, and now we have a big opportunity. So, you know, that's not very presidential. That's like a gang of incompetents running our foreign policy. And, in fact, we're living with the results today.
Well, and they sure didn't do a very good job of hunting down the terrorists. This seems like
God.
They all escaped.
No. Escaped. Every time we had them, we let them get away. You know, when your military is quite capable of doing all kinds of damage. We've got just an amazing amount. We have the most capable military on the planet. We have the most capable intelligence, at least technical intelligence capability on the planet. And, you know, if Arab media and Arab newspapers and television stations can get these, that can repeatedly get these tapes from bin Laden, you know, on a regular basis, it's like, what are we doing here? It's amazing to me that we haven't got bin Laden. I don't understand it. I don't understand it at all. And, if it goes on a whole lot longer, then you have to wonder if this is not by design. You certainly lose faith in the president's ability to make things happen. You know, we like to think in this country that our president is a strong president, and if he says, we're going to get bin Laden, you give him a year, but hey, it's been 2.5 years. We're not even close.
Well, no. I remember Matt Drudge right after September 11th saying, oh, he'll be dead in a week. We got satellites,
yeah.
Baby. We got the Predator. You're going down.
Sure, exactly.
We all expected him to be caught immediately.
Mm-hmm. And even if that was a little bit optimistic, 2.5 years, my goodness. I mean, the guy is connected. He's a Saudi. He's part of the royal family. He has this huge number of people. You know, we don't need the 6 degrees of separation. There's tons of people that are connected. The network is a living, breathing organism, and we still can't get this guy. So are we all incompetent, or is just George Bush incompetent? And quite frankly, I don't think our military is very incompetent. No, I think our military is great, okay? I think our military can do legitimate tasks that are asked of them, and yet they have been unable. And I think the military has been complaining. I've heard that, I mean, I remember various times, and Rumsfeld has echoed this, and he said, you know, we had bin Laden here and there, and we couldn't get him. In fact, that's one of Rumsfeld's reasons for why he put together his special access programs and all these things that Cy Hirsch has been writing about. I mean, what Rumsfeld is saying is, yes, I did. I really wanted to get bin Laden, and we had been handicapped. So what I did is I reorganized so that I could make sure we got him. Well, he reorganized to make sure we still don't have him. So what is that? You know, just,
well, and it was the FBI who caught Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in Pakistan.
Sure,
that wasn't
enough.
Soldiers. That was cops.
Well, there you go. And see, cops and soldiers, this is what that guy Jeff Record over at the Army War College has written about. He said, look, there's ways that you go about emasculating a network, okay? The criminal, you go through the criminal links, how they launder their money, how they get their money, how they train their people, what kinds of things they do when they're not blowing up buildings, okay? You go and get them on all these ways. This is police work. It's international police work. It's investigative work. It's not military work. It's not work for the United States Marines. There may be a small part that they do, but the way Bush has approached this is totally inappropriate, and that's why it has. It's one of the reasons it hasn't worked. You're using the wrong tool for the job. I mean, if you wanted to, we have toothbrushes to brush our teeth, but, you know, in some cultures they have sticks and twigs and other things, but some tools work better than other tools. It seems like we're picking the tool that works the least best and trying to use that to solve our problem. And, of course, it's not working. The definition of insanity, I know you know what that is, right?
Yeah, it's the same means over and over, expecting a different end.
Exactly right. Yeah, if people say that foreign policy is insane, hey, they have a point, because we're doing the same things, expecting different results.
All right, everybody. Karen Kotowski, definitely read her three article series in the American Conservative, available on the Internet, and also the new Pentagon Papers. She writes regularly for LouRockwell.com and Military Week. Thank you very much for coming back on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always fun to talk to you.
And I said your name right, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
All right. All right, everybody. You're listening to Radio Chaos, 95.9.